Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals living in the U.S. sent a record $27 billion to their families south of the border last year. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The surge was due in part to fears about President Donald Trump's threats to target that money, known as remittances, to finance the border wall he wants to build. Jean Guerrero of KPBS has the story.
52-year-old Teresa Gomez works at a grocery store in Barrio Logan, organizing merchandise and working the cash register. She reserves a third of every paycheck for her aging mother, who lives in the Mexican state of Jalisco.
I'm the one who provides for my mom. I'm the one who takes care of her, helps her buy food, pays for the doctor, everything she needs.
Her mother has heart problems and lacks health insurance in Mexico. Gomez immigrated to the U.S. as a teenager with the dream of supporting her. She sends her about $400 twice a month at a small money transfer shop called El Frijolito.
That's $400.
Gomez is one of millions of immigrants who sends money to family in Mexico. El Frijolito charges a fee of $5 or $10, depending on the desired exchange rate.
Okay, gracias. Listo.
Some people use larger transfer companies like Western Union. Last year, remittances surged to an all-time record of $27 billion. California set the largest chunk, $8 billion. The surge is due in part to President Trump's threats to target remittances as a way of forcing Mexico to pay for his planned border wall, which would cost anywhere between $5 and $25 billion. Gordon Hansen, dean of UC San Diego's School of Global Policy and Strategy, says a ban or tax on remittances would have to be broadly applied.
It would be basically a tax on electronic transfers. Now, the thing is, what's the difference between an electronic transfer that is a remittance versus a transfer between two business entities? On paper, they look identical.
As a result, he says, it would hurt not just people who are in the country illegally, but the entire San Diego economy.
You look at our construction industry, you look at bars and restaurants and hotels, so the San Diego tourist industry. Go into any San Diego neighborhood, and who is, you know, caring for yards, cleaning houses, and providing child care.
For example, Gomez is a U.S. and Mexican citizen. She lives in a small apartment with her bird, a conure parrot.
Kiko, kiko, kiko.
Gomez says Trump's threats worry her a lot.
How are you going to punish so many citizens who come as workers with good thoughts and acts in this country?
She says she would find a way to send money to her mother no matter what.
As a human being, or rather as a Mexican, nothing is impossible.
If need be, she could cross the border into Tijuana to transfer the money. But for immigrants who live far from the border or who lack legal status, it's more complicated. Marina is a 37-year-old immigrant who asked us to keep her identity secret for fear of deportation. She cleans houses and takes care of a 2-year-old girl, taking her on walks and reading to her. Marina also supports her sick mother in Mexico. She sends money every month for medicines and food.
I never go out. It's rare for me to go watch a movie or eat with a friend. Almost always I'm working.
She says Trump's threats scare her because her mother depends on her. And she's afraid of going back to Mexico, where homicides rose by 22% last year.
When I talk to my family, they tell me every day it's worse. They're even afraid to go out into the street because they killed someone here. They killed someone there.
She says if Trump wants to build a wall, he should do it.
I respect the new president because this is simply not my nation.
But she hopes Trump finds another way to pay for it because she can't afford it. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS talked with Jean further about the possibility of remittance taxes.
Do we have any idea how President Trump's administration would go about targeting remittances to Mexico? Has there been any policy put forth on how much the tax would be?
No. As for specifics, there aren't very many, actually. All we know is based on some memos that he put out during the campaign. Basically, we don't even know for sure that this scenario is going to unfold. The president has floated various ideas for how he would make Mexico pay for the wall, taxing imports from Mexico, repealing NAFTA. But targeting remittances does seem to be one of the most realistic, although it would have an enormous impact, not just on Mexico, but Mexican people living in the United States, as we saw in the story. But in one of the memos, he says that he would change a rule under the Patriot Act to cut off funds specifically from immigrants who can't prove legal status. He said that most of the remittances sent to Mexico are from people who are in the U.S. illegally. I should say that studies have shown that that's not necessarily the case, but we don't have the exact figures. It's unclear how the rule would work in practice, though. Policy and economic experts say it would have to change the operations of money transfers for anyone sending money to Mexico.
So how did you initially meet the two women in your piece?
So Gomez, I had actually met her before for a KPBS article on how California is responsible for most of the remittances. And she was initially reluctant about being in the piece just because she's shy and doesn't like to be on camera. But she agreed. But she's both a U.S. and a Mexican citizen. So she wasn't kind of the hardest source to get. And I wanted to find someone who specifically didn't have legal status and was sending remittances. And so I sent out a request among many of my sources. I already was in contact, actually, with people who sent remittances and didn't have legal status, but they didn't want to talk on the record. And that's actually one thing I've been finding a lot since President Trump was elected. A lot of people who were previously very open about talking to journalists, even, you know, talking openly about not having legal status, they've become more reluctant to do so. They're kind of pulling back, and their lawyers, if they have lawyers, are recommending that they stay out of the shadows, out of the spotlight, and because nobody knows how the president's immigration policies are going to unfold. But this woman, she ended up agreeing after several conversations and realizing that I would be protecting her identity.
Now, from your report, this proposed policy seems to hit the most vulnerable people, not only in this country, but in Mexico. How much fear do you sense in the people you've spoken with about this possible policy?
So I don't think I can do justice to the amount of fear that I'm sensing in them, particularly because remittances are huge for Mexico. It's the number one source of foreign income for the country after auto exports. So this would have an enormous impact. And like I said, people are so afraid they don't even want to give interviews. Some, like the two women I spoke with, they've spent their whole lives, their whole adult lives in the United States with the intention of just sending money back to Mexico. That's their only reason for being here. So if remittances are targeted, it's women like them who are going to feel the consequences, women breadwinners in the United States, women housewives and their children in rural Mexico who receive remittances from husbands in the United States. So as you said, some of the most vulnerable people on both sides of the border.
Now, one of the women you spoke to says she's going to find a way to send the money to her mother no matter what. Is that defiance also a reaction that people are having?
Yeah, across the board, that's what I've been seeing. They tell me that no matter what happens, they're going to find a way to send the money. They'll pay somebody to take the cash across the border. Or if they have the means like Gomez, they will cross themselves as often as they need to. But it will definitely be make people's lives more complicated.
Now, how are you planning to follow up this report?
So obviously, I'll be paying very close attention to Trump's announcements on how he intends to get Mexico to pay for the wall, seeing what developments occur there, and staying in close contact with the people who send money back to see how this affects them.
From KPBS in San Diego, that was anchor Maureen Cavanaugh speaking with reporter Jean Guerrero. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested nearly 700 undocumented immigrants in a number of cities across the country last week, including 51 in the Austin area. The arrests are concerning many immigrant communities, and anxiety is also making its way into schools. As KUT's Kate McGee reports from the state capitol, teachers and local education groups there are working to ease students' fears.
If an immigration officer goes to your door, what you have to remember is you don't open that door.
About 20 men and women sat in the cafeteria with their children at Rodriguez Elementary in South Austin after school. They listened to Unuin Alvarado with the local teachers union Education Austin.
So ICE can only enter your home if they have a warrant that is signed by a judge from a criminal court.
All of the people here are immigrants. They're attending one of Education Austin's Know Your Rights seminars. The union has a $30,000 grant from the National Education Association for this kind of work. It reviews what a person's rights are if ICE agents come to their home, stop them on the street, at a checkpoint, or at work.
So if you encounter an immigration officer on the street, the first thing that you have to remember there is that you don't run, because the moment that you run, that can be used against you. It makes you look guilty.
Some parents expressed concern about what would happen to their children if they were arrested while their children were at school.
If families are living in an apartment and they see the ICE band taking someone, then they take pictures and then people get worried.
That's Montserrat Garibay, vice president of Education Austin and a pre-K teacher.
It might not be a rape per se, but for people not knowing that these ICE agents have warrants, it's going to seem like a rape.
Garibay says it's difficult for immigrant families to get accurate information about what's happening and what their rights are.
One of the things that we really want to say to people, to communities, come down, have a safe plan, and then plan what are your next actions if that happens. That's our role, really, to tell people that they can get resources and know what to do.
Late last week, a number of people were arrested by immigration officers in the Austin area and in at least six other states. In a statement, ICE says it regularly conducts targeted enforcement operations to apprehend, quote, deportable foreign nationals. The agency denies that it was doing sweeps or checkpoints in the area. A lack of communication about the arrests caused confusion and panic in local immigrant communities. That anxiety bled into schools and the classroom.
Overall, I've been more quiet than usual, so I don't talk to friends as much about anything. So same goes for my parents.
That's Lisandro, a 14-year-old freshman at Austin Achieve Charter School in East Austin. He immigrated from Mexico. None of the students I spoke with wanted to give their last names because they are undocumented.
I feel useless when it comes to talking about these type of things that scare my parents. And I don't like the feeling that I can do a lot more, but I'm scared to do it. And I don't want to give in to the fear and just give up. But it's kind of hard to keep going when all of this is happening and you're just worried about what's going to happen to your family and everything else.
The lack of information about these arrests made students at Austin Achieve realize the need for more accurate information. 9th and 10th grade students spent time with worried middle school students. 16-year-old Katia was one of the students leading these conversations.
We got to talk in a circle, and then we find out that, yes, some people are just feeling really stressed and they don't know what's going on. So we have come to a conclusion that we need to put more information out there for like parents and scholars to know more about what's going on instead of just like randomly saying little pieces of things that they heard.
Katia came to the United States from El Salvador at 12 years old as an unaccompanied minor.
I don't know where I got the strength, but I just really wanted to like get here for the education, to see my family and just not go back to where I was. I just didn't want to be there. I didn't feel safe. So that kept me on walking.
Katia went days without food, crossed rivers, and walked 3 days in the desert before she was found.
The experience was, as I say, a really tenacious experience. It was really traumatic, but it shaped me how I am now. So I appreciate everything I have, and I do my best on everything I do, because that was the main reason I came here.
Austin Achieve students say teachers have been providing information about what to do if students encounter ICE agents, and they feel like school is a safe place. Montserrat Garibay with Education Austin says Austin ISD needs to keep telling its families that schools are safe too. Superintendent Paul Cruz sent a memo to the school community that included general information about resources for refugee and immigrant students. But Garibay says the district and the Austin School Board need to go farther than that.
Dr. Cruz and the school board members need to come out and say, this is a safe place. ICE is not going to come to our schools. I think that's very important for the families to hear.
The Austin School Board had been drafting a resolution in support of its immigrant and undocumented families for at least 6 months. But the resolution was stalled because of board politics and the current political climate. Last week, the Houston ISD School Board unanimously approved a similar resolution. Gary Bice says Education Austin plans to push the Austin School Board to pass its resolution as soon as possible.
In Austin, I'm Kate McGee.
Coming up on Fronteras, a Dakota pipeline protester doesn't feel defeated after a court ruling allowing construction.
This fight has awoken a people that have been asleep for a long time.
We'll explore more of her reaction when we come back.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. President Donald Trump recently fast-tracked construction permits for Dallas-based Energy Transfer to complete its oil pipeline in North Dakota, and a judge has refused to halt construction. Despite the setbacks, the Standing Rock Sioux, who see the pipeline as a threat to their drinking water, say they'll continue to fight in court and on the front lines. New Mexican Mayahuel Garza has made many trips to North Dakota to stand with the water protectors, deliver supplies, and offer traditional Aztec ceremony and dance. Garza spoke with KUNM's Marisa DeMarco about the latest developments and why she considers Standing Rock a rallying cry for pipeline protests everywhere, including the Trans-Pecos pipeline in West Texas.
It definitely brought me to tears. Just thinking about the people in camp and what they must be feeling at this time, just like, okay, we can't allow ourselves to feel defeated because we're still in the fight and it's still happening now and there's still hope.
So the Standing Rock Sioux are going to continue to fight this in court, saying there has to be an environmental impact assessment. Do you think that will stop the pipeline?
The Standing Rock Sioux tribe, as well as the Cheyenne River tribe, are both fighting this in court. I don't have very much confidence in the court, but I do have hope in the power of prayer, you know, and I believe that the people are going to do everything in their power to fight this.
If you pull back and you're thinking about what this fight has been, what do you think it will mean if the pipeline is built?
I honestly, truly do not believe that it would mean defeat, because this fight has awoken a people that have been asleep for a long time. Even if that pipeline is pumping oil underneath the Missouri River, the struggle has gone beyond Standing Rock. I think that it has already been a victory for our people, giving them that hope and that light and that drive to fight all these other pipelines. There's camps popping up all over, fighting pipelines everywhere. That's the ripple effect.
And we've seen that continue a little bit back here at home in New Mexico, too, right, with Chaco Canyon?
It was the, you know, immense amount of support that Standing Rock received and, you know, just everything that happened out in North Dakota that had an effect on what happened here in Chaco Canyon. But the fracking is still very real and alive happening in Chaco Canyon right now. And, like, you can drive out there right now and be witness to the fracking that's happening just right there.
When you made trips to go to the front lines, did you see violence against the water protectors?
Yes. Yes, I did see violence. And I recorded with my cell phone and I posted footage online. It was incredible to see, you know, the water protectors diving into freezing cold water and just holding their ground and seeing Martin County take over the hill and mace and pepper spray and tear gas the people. It's something that, although I feel very blessed and honored to have been able to be present and witness, is something that I felt this community should have never, you know, never have been faced with to begin with.
So you're heading back to Standing Rock. Why are you going again?
I'm heading back
to pick up supplies that right now are really needed and can be used at the Two Rivers Camp outside of Marfa, Texas. And they're fighting the Trans-Pecos pipeline, which is by the same company. We decided to also support this camp out in Texas. And so we are picking up water protectors out in Standing Rock and traveling to West Texas to the Two Rivers Camp.
That was KUNM's Marisa DeMarco speaking with Dakota Pipeline protester Mayawel Garza. The next court hearing on the pipeline is February 27th. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.